Before we begin, I just want to call your attention, as I often do, to some interesting things, respond to some questions. Some of you might have been following an interesting event that the uncensored, the illegally obtained diary of a Hasidic Rebbe, the Tolno Rebbe, that's the Tversky branch, but this is referring to in Israel, was put online. I could send anyone the link who's interested. What I think is relevant to what we've done is, you see from the Rebbe's conversations with the Gera Rebbe, that the Gera Rebbe respected Rav Kook, he says, more than Rabbi Sonnenfeld of the Eda Charedit. Someone asked me about, we spoke a lot about tzitzis in the first couple of classes, about is it really true that that you have to have a certain size for your tzitzis, 12 by 12 inches or anything else like that? And the truth is that it's a dispute. In fact, in Chaim Soloveitchik's article, Rupture and Reconstruction, he gives this as an example of what he calls the mimetic tradition versus the textual tradition. The mimetic tradition, that is the tradition, what people actually did, is that tzitzis does not have to have any size. The Aruch HaShulchan states explicitly, I'll read you the passage right now, Talis Katan, Shetachas HaBgadim, Ein Sarich Shior Kol. Find that in the Aruch HaShulchan, Aruch HaYim, Simen Tet Zayin, and that's because the Aruch HaShulchan often defends common popular practice, and in Europe, people didn't really concern themselves with how big the Talis Katan was. The Mishnah Brura, on the other hand, assumes that it does need to have a size, proper size, and if it's not the proper size, and you wear it outside on Shabbos, since you're only wearing it not as a garment, but to fulfill the mitzvah, you're actually carrying on Shabbos. The Tzitz Eliezer, which is also quoted by Soloveitchik, defends the Aruch HaShulchan's position and points out that how could you say you need to have a special size when no one wore it with a special size? I think that's interesting because I think today we actually do. I think we are careful to wear the equivalent of an amma by an amma, actually 18 inches. That's usually the standard, at least in my communities. Two other things. Oh, one of you asked me, this goes back over a semester. I never got to it. We spoke about Rabbi Reines. Someone wants to know, did Rav Reines have anything to do with the kollel that was established by Rabbi Yisrael Salanter? We spoke a bit about how Rabbi Yisrael Salanter established a kollel in Kovno, which really it's called the Kollel Prushim. It was the very first kollel in history. And I don't know where, I forgot even who asked me, I don't know where you heard this, but it is true. Rabbi Reines' son, Moshe Reines, describes how the very first thought of having a kollel came from Rabbi Reines. And the fact is that Rabbi Reines was the originator of the idea. It was his idea. His son Moshe Reines records this. And I said, although you didn't hear this, so I'll repeat it again, that the Haredi world today would probably be very upset to learn that the notion of kollel, the originator of it, the concept, comes from Rabbi Reines, the founder of the Mizrahi movement. But they'd be just as upset to learn that Torah Vadas, a well-known and distinguished Haredi yeshiva, where does the term Torah Vadas come from? It's the parallel to Torah Umada, Torah and secular studies. The fact is, the Torah Vadas was founded, among the founders was Rabbi Zev Gold, a leader of the Mizrahi movement. He was later president, I believe first president of the Torah Vadas, and they named it Torah Vadas, after the leader yeshiva, Reines' yeshiva, which was the first religious Zionist yeshiva in history, and the second yeshiva to teach secular studies. Shiva and Kelim of So I challenge anyone to go into Flatbush. I was there this weekend, although I didn't walk in, but to ask any of the Torah Vadas students there, do they know where the name Torah Vadas comes from? And which I'm certain they have no clue what Das means. In contrast to Torah, you have Torah and you have Das. Das means secular knowledge. They don't teach secular knowledge anymore. And if they know that it was named after the Mizrahi Yeshiva, the Levi Yeshiva, which created so much opposition, as we discussed in our classes on Rabbi Reines. Two more points. I was going to say this last week. when Bill was here. He's not here this week, so I'll say it again. We had a little discussion. He gave an example of what he thought was the low point in the response of Rabbi Menashe Klein, and I told him, and I'll tell you, that I only mean this half seriously. The low point in his response, with all these extremist and fanatical rulings, the low point has to be his response and his halachic ruling that it is forbidden to eat Chinese food, Japanese food, any of these things, because you can only eat, quote, Jewish food, as if there's such a concept. Those who've read my father's book on American Judaism, History of American Judaism, will see that reference to Menashe Klein there. The context of speaking about how kashrus went from, in the olden days, you might have a little deli on the Lower East Side to all the fancy restaurants, every possible cuisine imaginable, and that Menashe Klein is mentioned as someone flailing in the wind, someone who is opposed to Jews enjoying everything that they can, as long as it's kosher. After all, the Jerusalem Talmud says we'll be called to account for everything we could enjoy that we did not take advantage of. And finally, before we move on and return to the Chatam Sofer, I want to get back to Frankfurt for a few minutes. Customs of Frankfurt. We spoke about how the Chatam Sofer was from Frankfurt, but we had a class last semester, that we dealt with various practices in Frankfurt, formal practices, how only the rabbi could cover his head with a tallis, and all sorts of interesting practices. And a couple of you wanted some more examples. Some of these continue in Washington Heights and some don't. So I'll quickly just give you a few examples that I think you'll find fascinating. Bill Gewirtz mentioned what he thought was a low point in Rabbi Menashe Klein's psak, and I said the lowest point is really when he says that you can't eat Chinese food, Japanese food, you can only have, quote, Jewish food, as if there's something like that. And I mentioned before I was cut off, or after I was cut off, you didn't hear it, that if you look in my father's book on American Judaism, he talks a lot about, how society went from the deli on the Lower East Side to the situation we have today, the cornucopia, where at least in places like New York and Teaneck and Los Angeles, you have every type of Jewish food you can imagine. And there's a mention in that book of Rabbi Menashe Klein and his view, and of course that I could take credit for at least one thing in that book, and that's that. And the Jerusalem Talmud says that we will be called to account for every enjoyable thing we don't partake of that we're permitted to. The last thing I want to do before we begin is I was asked. This is really the last things I have in terms of everything that I've been holding to get to. Unless someone sends me questions for next week, 9 o'clock will start immediately on. We discussed various practices in Frankfurt, and people found them interesting. Things that maybe strike people as strange today, very formal. For example, the idea that only the rabbi could cover his head with a tallis. And someone asked, more than one, do I know any more of these practices? Because many of them don't exist anymore today, even in Washington Heights. So let me just quickly give you a few of them that I gathered together. In Frankfurt, that is, the Hirshian community, only the Gabayim were permitted to say Yashikoach after someone got an aliyah. It was considered improper for anyone else to do that. In Frankfurt, what else can I tell you? Oh, in Simchas Torah, there were hakafos and there were piyutim, but there were no dances, no dancing. The only dancing they had was that after reading the Torah, two people would hold the Torah, and they would go back and forth next to each other on the bima. And that was the extent of it. And in fact, the year I have here, sometime in the 1930s, I have to get the year, there was a group of people, these were people influenced by yeshiva students from Eastern Europe. In 1938, after davening, they began dancing. Dancing like we all do in our shuls. And Rabbi Yosef Breuer, got up and started speaking about how disgraceful this was. This is an embarrassment. And they disgraced the synagogue because they were actually dancing. And in Frankfurt, you don't dance.
You were not permitted to bring children under 5 years old into the great synagogue in Frankfurt, into Hirsch's synagogue, because they're disruptive. And you also couldn't enter without a kippah on. And if you understand what we've spoken about, that in Frankfurt, Jews did not wear kippot, except for places like Shul, that makes sense. In Chazarat HaShatz, one is not permitted to sing along with the Chazan. And if you would violate any of these things I told you about, the Gabayim would come and speak to you. What else can I tell you? Just one more. We spoke about opera. The head Chazan of Frankfurt, who was a great Chazan, he was actually asked to join the opera. And he agreed. But the synagogue vetoed it. They said that if he would go sing in the opera, he'd be fired from his position, and he thought that his position was better than the opera. We spoke about this last year when I talked about, because I had Judah Fisher on my Passover program. Okay, let us now return, and I'll be closing this, enlarging my picture in a minute when I get back to, after I show you something else. We were dealing with the Chatam Sofer. This is the second class. If you recall, we spoke last class how the Chatam Sofer was born in 1762. We went into some of his relationship with the great Rabbi Nachman Adler, the great Kabbalist. I just see now that I left certain papers upstairs and in my basement now, but I remember what I was going to review with you. We had some discussion last week. Ovadia pointed out that in Rabbi Nachman Adler's minyan, which created all the controversy, the Chatam Sofer says that no one else davens Sfard, just Rabbi Nachman Adler, and that's true. And in fact, the Chatam Sofer says that the Hafra, the Rav of the city, Pinchas Horowitz, also davened Nusach Sfard. However, I commented that I'm certain that some individuals, despite what the Chatam Sofer says, over time did start davening this way, and the truth is that in the 1930s, when the synagogue was still in existence, there was a publication that described their practices. And, for example, they said Keter in Shemona Esrei and Kedusha, that's Sephardic. They said Hodu before Baruch Sha'amar and various other practices. So it really did become a Sephardic-oriented synagogue. We ended last class. Well, let me just I'll pick up where we left last class. And if there's things I need... Binyamin Shlomo Hamburger, whom I mentioned a few times, who's written a great deal about Frankfurt and German Orthodoxy as a whole, has an article on Rabbi Nachman Adler, and he had some points I wanted to share with you. I could share next week. I also wanted to point out that the name that was given, Servis, however it's pronounced, as the Sofer family name, was correct. I actually had a note in my notes to see a certain source, but I forgot what it said, and I looked it up. I think it was Shlomo last week who told us what the name was, and not only did I have in that source the name, I had the whole description of where the name came from, of where the name Sofer came from. It's not Rabbi Moshe Sofer's father. I don't know if I might have said that by mistake. It's actually his forefathers, his great-grandfather and his grandfather. They were not Soferim in that they wrote Sifrei Torah. They were official scribes of the community. So, for example, when the community had letters to write to government officials or to record in the notebooks of the community who was born, who died, who got a get, a divorce. In fact, the Chatam Sofer's great-grandfather and grandfather, or it's his great-grandfather and great-great-grandfather, they actually wrote the Gittin as well. So they were Soferim of the community to do the Gittin, but they were not, there's no record that they wrote Sifrei Torah. We ended last class with me saying that the community issued a decree that because Rabbi Nachman Adler, this great tzaddik, this great Kabbalist, but his synagogue was creating all sorts of tension in the community, a decree was issued that no one was permitted to pray there. And yet Rabbi Nachman ignored this, as did his followers. One of his followers, Abraham Geiger's maternal grandfather, was his dayan. Rabbi Nachman Adler, although he was a great halachist, he had a dayan in his community that wanted to decide halacha, and that was Geiger's grandfather. So none of them listened, and they were put in chayrim. And finally, they ordered Rabbi Nachman Adler himself to close the minyan, or he would be put in chayrim. Now, according to Hutam HaShulash, which I quoted a lot last week, Chasam Sofer's grandson's book. He describes this whole thing. He describes how they closed all, they ordered all the other private minyanim to be closed to give Rabbi Nachman Adler respect. And Schreiber, that is Shlomo Schreiber, the author of Chutam HaShulash, claims that this is why Rabbi Nachman Adler agreed to leave Frankfurt, because he didn't want the Chilul Hashem or the problem of he personally being put in Cheirim. The implication being that it was okay for all of everyone else to be put in Cheirim, but when it came time to put him in Cheirim, he decided it was splitting the community too much, and he left. So according to Chutam HaShulash, and other sources as well, Rabbi Nachman Adler was never personally put under the ban, put in Cheirim, and yet the truth is that he was put in Cheirim. I don't know how to explain how the Chasam Sofer's grandson doesn't know this, but we actually have the text of the Cheirim. And it's included in the book. He was put in Cheirim twice, incidentally. 1879 was the first time. The second time, I don't think we can say he was put in Cheirim. I think the Cheirim was reaffirmed. But he was put in Cheirim in 1879. It's included, the text of it, in Walensky's book, Chasidim U'Mitnagdim, which, if anyone's interested in controversy, it's a great book, because it has all the Cheirims and texts by the Misnagdim against the Chasidim. So, in case you're wondering, what's a book dealing with the Chasidim and the Misnagdim, the opposition to the Chasidim doing having the Cheirim against Rabbi Nachman Adler? He's not a Chasidus. Chasidus is in the Ukraine and in Poland. The point is that the reason they put him in Cheirim, I don't think you can understand why they would have put such a great man under the ban without appreciating that the Jewish world felt under siege, the traditional Jewish world, by the Hasidic movement and the changes that were taking place. And here you have someone like Rabbi Nachman Adler, who's also creating a sectarian mentality, his own minyan, his own different practices that we spoke about. So for a rabbinic elite, a traditional rabbinic elite, that is already worried about what they're seeing in Eastern Europe with this new sectarian movement, the Hasidic movement, also people have in mind the Sabbatian heresy of 100 years before, when they see Rabbi Nachman Adler in Germany creating what looks like the kernel of a Hasidic movement, the only way to shut this down is to put him in Cheirim. And so you can't, as I said, appreciate why the response to Rabbi Nachman Adler was so extreme, because after all, what's the problem? Here's a tzaddik, he wants to have his own minyan, he wants to have a few different practices. Why should anyone care? But when you appreciate the fact that the traditional Jewish world is battling this Hasidic movement, we can appreciate why they felt they had to put him under the ban, and that's why the book is included in Chutam HaShulash. And I could send, if anyone's interested, I can certainly send anyone a copy of the Cheirim. Great figures have been put in Cheirim. You can go through the list. It's not just the Rambam. Many other great figures, and Rabbi Nachman Adler is one of them. So they go to Boskovitz. Oh, let me just tell you, when he comes back, we'll talk about Rabbi Nachman Adler returning to Frankfurt soon, the Cheirim on him is still in effect. But then he shortly after that becomes very ill in the summer of 1800, and the Cheirim on his shul is then lifted. People saw he was going to die, and they didn't want him to die in the Cheirim. They wanted to give him some dignity, so a few weeks before his death, the Cheirim is lifted, the synagogue is reconstituted, and it continues until the Nazi era. Now, when we talk about Rabbi Nachman Adler, it's hard to get good information, because he didn't write anything. Chasam Sofer himself is a very good source of information. Rabbi Nachman Adler's opponents in Frankfurt are a good source of information, and there's other traditions in Germany. In fact, Rabbi Nachman Adler never wrote down any of his Torah learning, any of his ideas. Who ever heard of such a thing, that a great sage doesn't write down his Torah thoughts? All that we know are things reported by the Chasam Sofer and other people, either in Frankfurt or elsewhere, who reported traditions. It's recorded by the Chasam Sofer's grandson that Rabbi Nachman Adler felt that it is forbidden to write the oral law. However, we all know we have a permission to do it because Eitz Lasot, it's an emergency measure. If we don't do it, then we're going to forget it. However, Rabbi Nachman Adler supposedly, I don't know if this is true, it sounds legendary, But it's supposedly, he believed that he pretty much remembered everything. He didn't forget his Torah. And therefore, he did not have permission to write it down because he didn't feel he was going to forget anything. It's only us mere mortals who will forget things, that therefore we have the permission to write it down. So we find something similar with the Chasam Sofer himself. He has a responsum to the great Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch Chayas. We've had classes on Chayas. And he writes to Chayas that in his day, that is in the early 19th century, there are authors of Torah works who every day are violating a Torah prohibition. Great rabbis who every single day are violating a Torah prohibition. What's the prohibition? He says they are putting the oral law in writing. We know you can't put the oral law in writing. And, well, why are they violating a prohibition? They would forget things, so they can put it in writing. Chasam Sofer says, like I just said, putting the oral law in writing is an emergency measure, because we're going to forget it. But the Chasam Sofer adds one more point. It has to be for pious reasons. But if you're doing it for egotistical reasons, because you want to be recognized as a great rabbi, and you want people to give you respect, avod, and that is why you're writing Sfarim, the rabbis never gave permission to put the oral law in writing for such a reason. They only gave permission to put the oral law in writing so you wouldn't forget it, so it would help you in your learning. But if you're putting it in writing in order to give kavod to yourself, so stroke your ego, things like that, that there never was prohibition. Never was permission to put it in writing. And the Chasam Sofer says there are many rabbis who are doing this, who are writing Torah down and publishing their books for egotistical reasons, and therefore these rabbis have all violated Torah prohibitions. Not right, doing it for the right purposes. If that's the case, it's almost impossible to find a person who's not violating it, but that's what the Chasam Sofer says. Now, he doesn't mention anyone by name. Only speculate which rabbis he had in mind. Don't take this to mean that the Chasam Sofer wouldn't criticize people by name. He does say that when he gets into a dispute, he's not going to be personal. He's only going to speak about ideas. However, we do see that on certain times, certain occasions, he does criticize people by name, and it's not considered Lashon Hara, because it's for a purpose, a good purpose, to well it. But in this case, he does not mention which rabbis, which great rabbis of his day, he believes are publishing books for egotistical reasons. Now, the Chatam Sofer stood by Rav Nachman Adler throughout the great dispute. I'm assuming the Chasam Sofer himself was in Chayrim, because he obviously davened with Rav Nachman Adler, and everyone who went to that show was automatically put in Chayrim. When Rav Nachman leaves Frankfurt, the Chasam Sofer goes with him. Rabbi Nachman Adler, a position was open in Boskovitz. German name, Boskovice, is how it's pronounced in Czech. We will be going there on our tour. I mentioned last class, an amazing synagogue there. We'll go to the cemetery, see all sorts of interesting things. A very old mikvah, for which they discovered. We'll see good stuff. Why was the Boskovitz community willing to accept a rabbi who was in Chayrim? That's an Adler who created all this controversy. No one writes about this. And yet I think I have a partial explanation. There were always battles for prestige and for importance between Frankfurt and other communities, in particular Prague. We're in Prague this summer, I'll tell some great stories, or if we do Prague rabbis next semester, some great stories about the battle between Prague and Frankfurt, because Prague thought that it had the greatest sages. It had people like the Notabi Yehuda, and it had the largest Jewish community in the Ashkenazic world at this time, and Frankfurt thought it had the greatest sages. It had people like the Pnei Yeshua and others, and they would battle with each other, and it wasn't only in good fun. It was very serious. So I think that Boskovitz, which is really in the environs, it's in the, I guess, the territory, you could say, the rabbinic territory of Prague. If the rabbis of Boskovitz had a question, they would turn to Prague. They wouldn't turn to Frankfurt. So therefore, hiring a rabbi who had been put under the ban in Frankfurt can be seen as a dig, as a way of challenging the rabbinate of Frankfurt. I think that's a proper explanation as to why. Now, it turns out that they would soon regret hiring Reb Nosson Adler, but if you want to know why they would hire a rabbi who created so much trouble, they were there from their attitude. I think it was, it's not Reb Nosson who created the trouble, it's these egotistical Frankfurt rabbis and Frankfurt community leaders who take a great tzaddik like Reb Nosson Adler and put him in Cheirim. So he comes to Boscovitz, and there were soon conflicts with the community as well, for reasons we can expect. His extreme piety and his mysticism didn't go over well with them, and he was gone after 3 years. He left. Chutam Ashulash, the Chasam Sofer's grandson, reports that there were people who said that at least, you know, we don't like Reb Nosson Adler, we can't deal with him, but it was worth having him as a rabbi because he brought the Chasam Sofer along with him. Chasam Sofer was, we're told, very popular in Frankfurt. I mentioned last class, when we were in Boscovitz, I will read the Chasam Sofer's account of Rabbi Nosson Adler and when his daughter died. It's amazing. So what did they like about Reb Nosson in particular? His chassidut, his piety. They complained. Why does Reb Nosson Adler do all these things that the previous rabbis didn't do, these pietistic acts? You have a city like Boscovitz, which had great rabbis in the past. And they did, let's say, they would have started Shabbos at a certain time. They dealt kashrus a certain way. And here you have a new rabbi, and the new rabbi is all of a sudden telling them that what they did in the past is not good enough. I think everyone listening now, and people are going to listen on the tape when you get it, have had similar experiences. You had big rabbis, you had traditions in your community, and a new rabbi comes in and says, well, yeah, you shouldn't do it the way you've been doing it. We have to change it. We have to do it differently. And, of course, the response of everyone is, what's the rabbi talking about? If it was good enough for Rabbi X, Rabbi Plony, why isn't it good enough for this rabbi? Any rabbi with some brains knows that if you try to change practices of a community, it's very problematic because the assumption of among the people will be you're being motzi laws. That's a rabbinic expression, means you're implying that the previous rabbis were not pious enough. You're not satisfied with the way they did things. And that's exactly what happened in Boscovitz. Rabbi Nosson wants the people, or I should say wants the people, wants he's doing certain things, and this will impact the people as well, which the other rabbis didn't do. You know that when Reb Nosson Adler was in Boscovitz, it's reported that when he did Tachanun, he did it with complete prostration like we do on Yom Kippur. I mean, he went down on the ground for Tachanun. Not only that, the Chasam Sofer did it when he went for Nosson. So here you have a situation. You have a shul. It's the shul in Boscovitz. That's why this trip, by the way, is so amazing to Europe. Keep trying to sell it. We're going to be in a shul where Reb Nosson Adler davened. We're going to be in the shul where the Chasam Sofer was. We're going to be in Prague where Reb Yonasan Eibschitz, the Notav Yehuda, the Tosas Yom Tov, all the great Rabbanim. We don't have this experience in America. We don't have this experience in Israel either. For hundreds of years they were there. So here you have shul. Just imagine the scene. Tachman comes and Reb Nosson Adler, the Chasam Sofer, and probably a few other people, they fall on the ground doing complete prostration. No other rabbi in Boscovitz ever did that. This is going to create problems in the community. When the Reb Nosson Adler died and the Chasam Sofer gave his hesped, he also did complete prostration on the ground. As part of the hesped, he did that. So, trouble in Boscovitz with Reb Nosson Adler. So he leaves, and the Chasam Sofer goes with him. There is no record of any student following Reb Nosson to Boscovitz or leaving with him from Boscovitz to Frankfurt. Just the Chasam Sofer. He obviously had students, other people who were students of his in Frankfurt, and he had other students of his in Boscovitz. But none of them came with him except for the Chasam Sofer. At least we don't have any record. And the Chasam Sofer just assumed he continued to follow him. After all, Reb Nosson Adler was his master. Yes, he studied with Rabbi Shire in Mainz, as we mentioned. He studied with Rabbi Horowitz, the Hafla, or Pinchas Horowitz, who put his Rebbe in Cheirim. But these were not the same level. His true teacher was Reb Nosson Adler, and he was with him every single day. They spoke in learning every single day, not just in learning. Reb Chasam Sofer's personality comes from him in many ways. And he assumed he would continue following him. By the way, since we're speaking of Boscovitz, Moravia, or Pinchas Horowitz's brother, who went over to the dark side, as it were, who became Hasidic, he was the Rav of Nicholsburg. That's Rav Shmuel Shmelka of Nicholsburg. Rav Pinchas Horowitz, looking at what happened to his brother, how his brother became a Hasid, that might have affected also the way he dealt. I haven't checked to make sure the chronology is correct, but that could have affected the way he dealt with Rav Nosson. I have to check. I'm just saying this off the top of my head now as a speculation. I have to check if Rav Shmelka went to the Hasidic side before or during the same period that Rav Nosson was going through all these problems. Here. Okay, so they're going together. And as I said, the Chasam Sofer assumes he's going to continue on to Frankfurt. And yet when they reach Firth in Germany, Rav Nosson says to him, it's time for them to separate. I don't know if any of you are familiar with the famous story of the Buddha, when the Buddha decides to leave the palace and he's with his horsemen, and they come to a place and the Buddha says, now I have to go off on my own and you have to go off on your own. And it's a very important aspect of the beginning of Buddhism, and I thought of that when I saw this, that Rav Nosson tells the Chasam Sofer, it's now time for you to go off on your own, to make your own way. You can't follow me anymore. And it obviously was traumatic and difficult for the Chasam Sofer, but they separate. And the Chasam Sofer goes his way, and a few years later, he's no longer alive, and the Chasam Sofer goes his way. He moves to Prusnitz, the city in Moravia, not such an important city, and we do not know why he went to Prusnitz. There was no rabbi in the community at that time, and it could be, at least the speculation is, he went there precisely because there was no rabbi, not that he wanted to be the rav of the community, but in those days, every rabbi also had a yeshiva. That was part of the rabbinic contract. When you signed a contract, the community agreed to support a certain amount of students. And if it was a big community, like we'll see in Pressburg, they agreed to support lots of students. And smaller communities might only agree to support 5 students. So a good pulpit is one where you can have 10, 20, 30, however many students you can get. Since there's no rabbi in Prusnitz, there's no yeshiva, because the rabbi ran the yeshiva. So the Chasam Sofer, he can go there and open up a yeshiva. It could have been that there was maybe a kernel of the yeshivas, but there's nothing significant there. So he goes there, and almost immediately people begin to gather around him, and he has a yeshiva. And he also gives shiurim classes for the balabatim. And that's significant because most rabbis actually didn't give classes for the balabatim. They would give a drasha occasionally, but they didn't actually give classes. So the Chasam Sofer is doing more than most, but he's not serving as rabbi. See, if you're the rabbi, you don't have a job to give classes to the balabatim. Someone else would give a class, but that wasn't your job. The Chasam Sofer is there just teaching Torah, so he also decides to give classes to the lay people. Now, he needed special permission to live in Prusnitz, because there was a rule at this time. There's something called the Familians Law. We talk a lot about this in the summer trip in Bohemia and Moravia. The law had been passed that there was, days of Maria Theresa, there was a limit on how many Jews could live. Jewish households could live in Bohemia and Moravia, and that was set when the law was passed at the end of the 18th century, and to the middle of the 19th century it wasn't changed, and the numbers never changed. Despite the fact that you had increase in Jewish population, all the Jews had to leave, or they had to marry secretly and illegally. And that could get them in a lot of trouble. You could only marry, the oldest son was the only one permitted to marry, and he could only marry when his father died, because the households had to remain the same. What this meant in practice was a great migration of Jews out of Bohemia and Moravia to Hungary, where even though this was still under Maria Theresa's rule, the familiant law didn't apply there. So there were certain people who got exceptions. If you're a teacher, they would give exception of a rabbi, things like that. So the Chasam Sofer was permitted to dwell there. Yeah, he got special permission. And while there, he married a local woman. Let me just make a note. I want to check something. Next class. Tell you. A very good book came out recently. by Michael Miller of the Central University of Budapest on Jews of Moravia, the rabbis, a lot about Shimshon Raphael Hirsch. He has discussions there about what was going on in the Moravian Jewish community, talking the mid, before 1848, before the revolution, in the 1840s, when these rules, 1830s, were still in existence. You had the phenomenon where Jews basically were living, in the technical term, in concubinage. They couldn't legally get married, so they were either living with women, or you could find maybe a rabbi to perform the wedding, but that was very difficult because that's a crime. And you read the rabbis, how they talk about the immorality. You have communities of Shomer Shabbos religious Jews, but the only way they can have a family is to just live with someone and do this illegally, because it wasn't even legal to live out of wedlock. So the government restrictions were forcing otherwise pious Jews into relationships of concubinage, having concubines, because they were not legally permitted to be married. This is something that I don't think most people know about the situation. I mean, we hear so much about pogroms and the problems of Jews in Tsarist Russia, but how Jews in Moravia, Moravia, their population, their quota of families was set for many years. The Chasam Sofer, as I said, married a local woman, one who was older than him. Yet it was a good deal because her brother was quite well off, and he agreed to support the Chasam Sofer while the Chasam Sofer was studying and teaching. In other words, the Chasam Sofer didn't have to work for a living, didn't have to get money anywhere else. And he married somewhat late. Approximately, when he was approximately 25 years old, he married, and that's late in those times, for most people at least. Talmud says you should marry at 18. And he was asked by his son about this. In fact, this page, if you anyone wants to see, in the Chutzah Mashuach, page 7b, the Talmud says you're supposed to get married at 18. Chasam Sofer says that he was asked this question by his son, who was the rabbi in 70, the rabbi in Krakow, Rabbi Shimon. I'll read you the exact passage here. See, his son asked him, why aren't you concerned if the Talmud says get married at age 15? And he answers his son, you should know that harbei dam shafachti avor zeh. I spilled a lot of blood over this. That is bloodletting. Bloodletting used to be a way to, they used to do bloodletting for all sorts of illnesses and diseases, and so why was the Chasam Sofer doing bloodletting here? Picture here for a minute. Here's my picture. Hold on. Expand my picture so you can see it better. Well, I don't know if it really makes it any different, but kedei lahachli shkufi, lahakim retichat habacharut. Basically, he's saying in order to get rid of the hormones, at 18, 19, 20, he would do bloodletting. So I think that's incredible. Later on, the story is told, it's told in many different places, in Chutzah Mashuach and the other biographies, that his mother actually wanted him to come back to Frankfurt, married there. So one of his relatives had died and left with the Beit Din of Frankfurt like a dowry, not a dowry though, because it's a man, but a sum of money that to be given to him when he got married, if he came back to Frankfurt and got married, but he didn't want to. And one of the reasons was he could have gone back there to learn and then get married. He didn't like the culture in Frankfurt because in Frankfurt, the yeshiva students wouldn't get married to approximately 30 years old, which is very late. And he didn't like that. Let's move on. We've spoken a few times about the ethos of the community of the rabbis, how so different it is than ours. If you Chutzah Mashuach, you can see on page 23, and this is repeated again in the different biographies, tells the story about how his mother, who was quite elderly, wanted to see her son. He had been absent for many years now. He had left Frankfurt to Boskovitz, and he went to these other places to return to see her. And he wrote a letter to the Beis Din in Frankfurt, because if he would leave, and when he leaves, you're not talking about just one or two days, it's a few weeks, it would mean there wouldn't be any Torah study at all. All the students he was teaching wouldn't have a teacher, if that's permissible. And the Beis Din replied he should stay where he is, not go see his mother, because Torah study trumps honoring your mother, kibud av v'aim. And so he never saw his mother from the time he left Frankfurt with Rav Nosson Adler until her death. In 1794, the Chasam Sofer becomes rabbi of another city, Reznitz. It just occurred to me, if I'm not mistaken, it's either Chaim Grad or Isaac Basheva Singer. They have a story like this, where the main character is away at yeshiva, must be Grada, and I think it's Singer. Some of you next week could tell me. He refuses to go back home to see his mother, and his mother has to come to the yeshiva to find him. I mean, he refused to go see her. In 1794, Chasam Sofer becomes Rav in another Moravian city, Dresnitz. But this wasn't such a good position, because the community didn't support the yeshiva. Didn't support a yeshiva. Who wants to be there? No, I think Barak asks, so there was the issue of not talking to his father. By this time, his father was already dead. That wasn't a concern anymore. That was another issue. He wouldn't speak to his father, but he did speak to him. He would mail his letters to his mother. In fact, the traditional story is that he sent someone else in his place to tell his mother that everything was okay. There's a few different versions, but they all agree that he sent a messenger to Frankfurt to speak to his mother, but he personally did not go to Frankfurt to see his mother. Again, even today, it's hard in the yeshiva world. I can't imagine anyone following such a thing, but it shows you the difference in outlook. Getting back to the Chasam Sofer, he's in Dresnitz. He's able to get them to maintain a few students. That's it. So very unhappy in Dresnitz. But he's there for 5 years. After this, he's called to be Rav. That's the expression they always use, that he accepts a calling, in Mattersdorf, which is an important kehila, an important community. Mattersdorf is one of the so-called seven kehilot, sheva kehilot. Even Gemeinde. What are these seven kehilot? Eisenstadt. The only one of the seven kehilot we'll be going to this summer is Eisenstadt, which is today in Austria. See, the Jewish Museum of Austria is in Eisenstadt. And we know Eisenstadt because we had classes on Rav Israel Hildesheimer, who opened up the first yeshiva with secular studies in Eisenstadt. He's not buried there because he then went on to Berlin, but we will see the cemetery, important figures. One of the graves is a pilgrimage site. The mayor of Eisenstadt. There's a lot I will talk about Eisenstadt. The synagogue and the Jewish area is right next to the palace of Esterhazy. Esterhazy was the noble family. Dukes or I don't know what the official title. I think they were dukes. But this noble family, Esterhazy, they owned the city of Eisenstadt, and they protected the Jews, and the Jewish quarter is right next to the palace. Castle. It's not a castle, it's a palace. So that's the first. The second of the cities, Mattersdorf, Hobersdorf, Lachenbach, Frauenkirchen, Kitze, and the seventh of the seven kehilot, the seven communities. And these communities, incidentally, had the minhagim, which were common to most of them. They had cultural and religious connections. The seventh community is Deutschkreuz. Now, Deutschkreuz means German cross. So you can be sure, or German crucifix even, but German cross. You can be sure that Jews are not going around calling their town Deutschkreuz. I mean, it's one thing they call it Frauenkirchen, but to call it Deutschkreuz, they won't. Those of you who know a bit of Jewish history, you might have heard of the town Salem. Salem is Deutschkreuz. Jews did not want to call it a cross, so they gave it the name Salem. What's it, Salem? It's Salem in Yiddish. It's an image. You would refer to a crucifix or a cross as a Salem. So Salem is not an actual term. It's just a Yiddish way of referring to Deutschkreuz. If I'm not mistaken, Kedem wine, when I was growing up, used to have the hashgacha of the Tzelem Arav. And there still is a Tzelem Arav. It's not a Hasidus, but this is the last Rav who was the Rav of Tzelem. He came to America, so he did hashgachas. So those are the seven kilot, and Mattersdorf was the most important of these seven kilot. He establishes a yeshiva there to which many students come. And he's there for 9 years. Perhaps some of the people listening right now, descend. Let me know, please, privately. You can email me, descend from a family in the 7 kilot. In 1896, the important community, the important kahila of Pressburg, invites him to become the rabbi. Pressburg, today, capital of Slovakia, known as Bratislava, it was a very important city. There were great battles there. Napoleon had a great battle there. One of the emperors, I forget which one, I think it was Francis, taken the son of Maria Theresa, or was it, I believe it was the son of Maria Theresa, I have to check, was crowned in Pressburg. A big, beautiful castle there. The Jewish quarter is right near the castle. That was typical. Usually in places like this, the Jews would have protection from the lord, or from the duke, or whoever was in the castle, the prince. It was the townspeople that wanted to cause the Jews trouble. Pressburg is not far at all from the 7 kilot. It's only, by car, it's about 45 minutes from Vienna. But it's not a suburb of Vienna. It's its own important city. Culturally, it comes to be in the orbit of Vienna, because by the mid-19th century, we'll see when we get to the Ktav Sofer, people are all speaking German. That's the Viennese influence. But it was the most important community in that part of Europe. Leaving Vienna out, Vienna is really in the Germanic side, and Pressburg is really the Hungarian, then becomes more Germanic, but at this time it's Hungarian, regarded as Hungarian, even with Moravian influence. It was the most important community in that part of the world. Now, the Chasam Sofer wanted to go there. First of all, he could have a great yeshiva there. There were great yeshivas even before him. The previous rabbis had yeshivas, but nothing like he was going to establish. If they had 50 students, that was a great yeshiva, or 100 students, but he would have many more. And Pressburg has a long tradition of great rabbis. We will see this summer the graves of a few of the great rabbis were not destroyed. Cost the Jewish community $2 million, apparently, during the war years to pay off the Slovakian anti-Semitic government when they destroyed the rest of the cemetery and built roads and everything else they did. There's a train station up there, or a trolley station, everything they built. Keep these few graves cost a fortune, and they are underground, the graves. To this day, they're underground. We will go visit them, but a few of the rabbis who were buried next to each other, including the predecessor of the Chasam Sofer, are still found there. So this is a big coup to go to such a position. While he's in Pressburg, all the future Hungarian rabbis study with him. It is almost impossible to find a Hungarian rabbi of any significance from, from the 1830s on, who assumes a pulpit from the 1830s on, who was not a student of the Chasam Sofer. During its peak, there were approximately 400 students at the Pressburg Yeshiva. Enormous number. I would love to show you the yeshiva, to show you pictures of it. Those who are coming with me this summer, take you there. Unfortunately, I can only show you where it was. Right now, there's a hotel, the Ibis Hotel, I-B-I-S, is standing right where the old Pressburg Yeshiva used to be. Then, later, when the yeshiva moves, it moves right next to, and the yeshiva building, which existed until the 1960s, that moved more north, up the hill closer to the castle, but that was destroyed by the communists when they built this bridge and they had to put in a road. So today there is no synagogue. There's no yeshiva, neither the first yeshiva or the second yeshiva of Pressburg are not to be found. And the synagogue, with the Chasam Sofer and the Kassav Sofer died, these were all destroyed when the old Jewish corner was uprooted in order to build this bridge, and they had to build roads to get to it. The only synagogue in Bratislava, which is a beautiful synagogue, it's in the center of town, was established, I think, in 1923 or 24. That's all that's left. We are told that in achieving this position, it's 10:01, but we're going to go for another 5 minutes because of the time we missed, that the Chasam Sofer beat out some important people. First, he beat out Rabbi Akiva Eiger, who will soon be his father-in-law. Rabbi Akiva Eiger from Posen is a very big figure, very important figure, and the community chooses Chasam Sofer Rabbi Akiva Eiger. He also beat out Rav Baruch Teomim Frankel, known as the Baruch Tam, the Rav of Leipnik in Moravia, who's soon also a pilgrimage site, but we won't be going there this summer. So he's appointed Rav of Pressburg. His first wife dies when he's in Pressburg, and he hasn't had any children. For his second marriage, that's when he marries the daughter, Sarah. She's known as, the first wife also is reported as named Sarah. The second wife is Sarah, but she's known as Sarah, S-A-R-E-L, and Avadia, who's not with us this week, told me, I didn't know about this, that it's a tradition in the Sofer family to name girls Sarel because of this daughter. There were some people who, for whatever reason, did not want this marriage to go forward. I want to read you what it says. Utamashosh. Sarel, yes, Sarel is Sarel. But the question is, Bill, is the name Sarel that we know, that... the development of the name Sarah? Or is this just a separate name that because Sarah sounds like Sarah, that when you named a kid Sarah, you gave her more of a vernacular name, Sarah? I mean, I'm not sure. Maybe you know the answer to that. Is that common in Yiddish-speaking homes that girls who are named Sarah, today we call them Sarala, which is a diminutive. So is Sarah an adaption of the name of affection? Sarah becomes Sarah? So you say, no, it's a different name. Okay, that was my question. Thank you for enlightening me on this. Because everyone knows that the term of affection for Sarah is Sarah. Okay, thank you very much. But I don't know, really. Akiva Eiger named his daughter... name was Sarah. Possibly in the German environments, it was common, pretty standard, to have both a German name and a Hebrew name. In any event, your name is Sarah. Hutamashuash records that there were people who didn't want this marriage to go forward, that it didn't want his grandmother to marry the Chasam Sofer. And the reason they came to the Chasam, he doesn't explain why. What the reason would have been for this, on page 16b, he just describes it as, I'll tell you the description here, he claims that they didn't want the two great sages, to become one family. I don't know how realistic that is. We will see next class that there were people who were great enemies of the Chasam Sofer. And everything he did, they challenged him. You won't get this in the hagiographies. For the hagiographies, everything is great. The Chasam Sofer comes to town, and everyone falls in line. We will see next class that the mockers of the community turn to the government to try to destroy the Chasam Sofer. You can accuse him of being a liar. So the fact that they tried to stop the marriage, that could be the reason. But the story he tells is that they told the Chasam Sofer that they have to stop this marriage, that they agreed, in other words, they agreed in writing. The Gemara says you're supposed to see the bride before you get married. So, okay, I guess the Chasam Sofer thought he'd see the bride, and then he'd get married 10 minutes later. They told him that the bride-to-be, in menuvelet me'od, demara paneha, shorahi, onava. In other words, she's ugly. She's disgusting looking. So they go to the Chasam Sofer and say that Rekiva Ayer's daughter is ugly, disgusting, you can't marry her. And there's other chasronos, other problems in her body and her spirit that is mentally, she's not all there. So these people claim this, and then he says, therefore, the leaders of the community came to the Chasam Sofer to talk about this. You know, what's going on here? You sure you know what you're getting into, Chasam Sofer? And the son, the grandson says, you know, this is not the way of the Chasam Sofer. He doesn't, he's not concerned with matters of physical beauty and everything. And he had been assured by people he trusted that she was a proper woman. But in order to stop the problems, the community actually sent two Anashim Ne'amanim, two trustworthy people, to Eisenstadt. Because Rabbi Akiva Eiger, he wasn't living in Eisenstadt then, but he's from Eisenstadt. In fact, in the cemetery, it's his whole family, and his daughter was living with the grandparents in Eisenstadt, his grandmother. And they went there, and when they got there, they didn't know what's going on here. In fact, they were shocked at the insolence of these people to say that she's ugly and all these sorts of things, when it was obviously not the case. And they come back and report that all is well, and you could get married, and the marriage would take place shortly after that in Eisenstadt. So the Chasam Sofer travels to Eisenstadt, because that's where the bride is living. The bride herself was widowed. She had two daughters at this time. The Chasam Sofer would raise them like his own, get them shiduchim. The Chasam Sofer would have three sons with her. The Ketav Sofer, who we're going to get to eventually, Rav Avraham Shmuel Sofer, Rav Shimon Sofer, who becomes Rav of Krakow, and someone named Yuzka, who was not a Talmud Chacham, but just a... And then there was another son named Yitzhak Leib. He dies at age 4. Another great story is that he dies on Yom Tov, and Chasam Sofer tells his wife, we've discussed examples like this a few times already, you can't mourn. You can't be upset. There's no mourning on Yom Tov. So let me read you this. It happened on Sukkot. Ve'im Rishayi Gadel, you can't mourn. And she, the great tzaddikah she was, you did not see any tears on her face until after the holiday. Whether it's true or not, I do not know. But we've seen numerous examples of this, even Rabbi Soloveitchik. Famous story is his brother died on Yom Tov. He got news of it on Simchas Torah, I think it is, and he continued dancing, and only started crying after the holiday was over. In addition to this, he had 7 daughters. So the Chasam Sofer has 3 sons, 7 daughters, 3 sons that survived, 7 daughters. With all these children, we can understand why there are descendants of Chasam Sofer everywhere. I know at least 3 or 4 different descendants of them. And in every family, every community, you'll find people who are descended. Certainly in the Haredi world, he had 10 children, each of whom married, many of whom married important rabbis. I see it's already 10:08, so we're going to stop here. I'll stay on a few more minutes if you have questions. Next class, we'll begin with what happens when the Chasam Sofer comes to Pressburg. And as I said just before, don't believe the hagiography. Like, the hagiography describes him coming to Frankfurt, coming to Pressburg as a triumphal king, and the community all lines up. No. The machlokas, the disputes started from the minute he came to Frankfurt. And these were not just ignorant people. Some of the people who opposed him were quite learned. Or I should say, people who didn't fall in line with him. And we will talk about this. And we'll see there was Haskalah in Frankfurt. And in Pressburg, sorry, and even the beginnings of reform in Pressburg. So we will deal with that next class. The Chasam Sofer had real troubles. But let's remember what the Yisrael Salanter said. The Yisrael Salanter said that any rabbi who doesn't have people in the community trying to get rid of him is not a real rabbi. Obviously, if you're not upsetting people, if you're not getting them angry at you, you're not really doing your job. But Rabbi Yisrael Salanter also said that any rabbi who allows them him out. Not a mensch. That is, in other words, you have to have this middle ground. Get enough people upset and angry that they know you're doing your job, but don't get too many angry that they can actually drive you out, because that shows that you're not acting like a mensch. That shows you're going too overboard. That's what Rousseau Salanter said. And we'll see, the Chasam Sofer definitely got people upset, but not only did he not get enough upset to get rid of him, his son becomes Rav after him, his grandson becomes rabbi after that, and his great-grandson becomes rabbi, the last rabbi of Bratislava, Pressburg, before the Holocaust. I don't know of any other examples where you have a rabbinic dynasty of three successions, that is, four generations, Maybe some of you can let me in on one, but I don't know of any other community where you have a four descendants, as father, son, grandson, great-grandson, to hold the same rabbinic position. This despite the fact, as I mentioned, that there was a terrible, terrible dispute that takes place in Pressburg with the Chasam Sofer, who was by far the most distinguished of all these rabbis, most distinguished in his generation. His first wife did have kids. Yes, Shlomo. She had two children, the first wife. So if you count those children, he had 12 children because he raised them and he arranged for shiduchim and dowries and everything. Shlomo says that Burak writes that people were against the shidduch and spread rumors that she was ugly. Yes, this comes all out of the grandson's book, Chutz HaMashuah. Shlomo Burak, I ordered it from a university library, Shlomo, so I'll see the book tomorrow. Burak is a quasi-semi-popular, it's not a scholarly book, it's not a popular book, it's somewhere in the middle, biography of the Chasam Sofer. So his biography is taken out of Chutz HaMashuah or one of the other books. In other words, Shlomo, he's not a primary source in any of these things. He's a rabbi writing in, the 1960s? But it's good. For those who want to read about the Chasam Sofer, it's a good book, Shlomo tells me, Burak. Yes, Shlomo, I said, were you not, maybe he was cut off. He had four sons. He had Kasav Sofer, he had Reb Shimon, who became rabbi in Krakow. Remember what I said last week, that cultural differences were really not significant, that you can go from Bratislava to Krakow. Then he had Yuspa was not a rabbi, and then he had Yitzhak Leib. Yitzhak Leib was the one who died at age four, so he had four sons. But when I said he had three sons, I meant afterwards, I said he had three sons who married, who made it to... Yitzhak Leib died at age four, so no one today is descended from Yitzhak Leib. I'm assuming Burak mentions that, doesn't he, that Yitzhak Leib died? If not, okay, yes, thank you very much. I will get a hold of Burak by next week to see if I missed anything that he puts in that's worthwhile. There's so much about the biography, I really can only touch the surface. There's a whole book put up by Hamburger called Memories and Traditions about the Chasam Sofer, which has collected biographical essays on the Chasam Sofer by various students and other sources. It's a big book, probably about 400 pages, and in each one of these, you have personal recollections and other stories about the Chasam Sofer. Remember what I said last class? We literally could have 20 classes on the Chasam Sofer and still have plenty to do. I will spend three classes on the biography. I think it'll be three classes. And then we'll spend some classes, maybe four classes, on what makes him so significant. But go on and on. About the Tachnun, does it violate Chadash Asr Min HaTorah, prostrating yourself? Well, Rabbi Nassim Adler certainly was not concerned with Chadash Asr Min HaTorah because he was doing a lot of new things. And these Tachnun things came about before this expression, Chadash Asr Min HaTorah, came about. The Chasam Sofer did not continue doing complete prostration, but when he was with his Rebbe, he did that. We will talk about Chadash Asr Min HaTorah. Everything new is forbidden by the Torah, and we will see that it really has very limited applicability. It only refers to the battle against reform, those sorts of things. Even though the expression was first used with regard to Chadash, the new grains. We spoke last class about umbrellas and all that. I don't know if any of you do what I did. As soon as we finished last class, I plugged into Google, Rabbi Google, umbrellas and Shabbat, and you find a number of good articles that deal with the Chasam Sofer, his view on it. The Chasam Sofer says that it's divrei chassidut. It's a pious thing not to have an umbrella on Shabbos. But in terms of practical halacha, he doesn't see any problem at all with carrying it if it's already open, and even that is a stringency to have the non-Jew open it for you. He actually thinks there's no problem even opening it, and certainly if it's already open. So those who wanted the details, you can find a lot about it there. Okay, I don't see any more questions, even from Yisrael. Yisrael, anything you want to add? Oh, Yisrael had to get off. Okay, so we will stop here now. Next class is the last class of the semester. I'd like to do it 8. Next class is the 8th. We'll then take the break for Pesach. So we have a smaller than usual class tonight. Maybe they're all watching Obama. He's on TV talking about why we're going to war in Libya. Whatever the reason is, we have more people who listen not live than who listen live, but it's always good to have as many as you can live. So for those who are not here with us live this week and are now listening to my voice sometime during the week of the last week of March, we look forward to seeing you on April 4th, which will be the last class of the semester. Good night, everyone.